For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. So, I recently had an experience at the cemetery. An older woman passed away, was laid to rest. Her even older sister was only surviving sister, elderly sister was there. This woman's life had spanned the century. Very elderly lady, remarkably spry for her age. So after the funeral, my wife and I went over to her and offered her words of consolation. And she said, "You know, the only thing I feel bad about," she said, "my sister would have loved to have heard this." That's what she said. So my wife said, you know, like, what do you say at the time? My wife said, "I'm sure she did hear it." You know? The lady turns to her daughter and says, "She believes that." That's a really interesting comment. Because actually, it comes from a certain time and a certain place. In other words, my wife was saying something to the effect of the soul, or people still here with us, and souls are eternal, and they hear, and they know, and they're aware, and or whatever it was she was saying. She was really just trying to say something nice at the time. And what this lady was saying is, yeah, she believes all that hocus-pocus stuff. But, you know, we all know there's nothing to any of that. That comes from a certain time and a certain place. And I believe that that attitude is actually very much prevails today. When I teach, when I explain, if there's a midrash, I take great pains to make sure that I give the meaning to it in some way that it sort of rationally makes sense, that it's an ethical idea, and so on and so forth. And if I talk to you about the reference in the Gemara to Shadim, for example, demons, so, you know, I'll be sure to explain, give some type of explanation, so that it somehow fits within a rational frame of mind. Why is that? Why do we do that? Why do we take great pains to do that? That is, I believe, because we live in the either age of reason, or more likely, more exactly, post-age of reason. And that is what I want to speak to you about tonight. The age of reason, it often called the era of enlightenment, identified by most of us as the era of emancipation, and the product that came out of that, which many of us know by the term of maskilim. That's what we're going to speak about tonight, really the maskilim. But in order to understand the maskilim, we have to understand the whole milieu and really the world that produced them. And actually, that world that produced them, it really is, in many ways, the world that we live in. Because most of the values that came from that world are the world that we live in today. Except, as with all great trends and all mindsets, they are ultimately taken to their maybe logical or perhaps illogical extreme, and then they fall apart. And it's all just a question as to how many decades or centuries it takes for that to happen. So let's roll the clock back into the early 1700s. The Renaissance has ended, and the age of reason has arisen, and we're finding men like John Locke, the famous John Locke, English philosopher, who is beginning to speak about ideas new ideas, new approaches to life. Once upon a time, life was viewed as a top-down experience. All the way on top is God. And underneath that, there is whoever, the king, the emperor, whatever he is. And underneath that are all other nobilities. And underneath that are free men. And underneath that are women. Underneath that are children. And underneath that are slaves. And that's the way the world is structured. And first of all, no one would dare consider stepping out of their class because that is the way that it has been ordained. Who says you have a right to step out of class? And second of all, even if you would dream of stepping out of class, no one in the class above you would tolerate it anyway. So you're not going to get away with it. You know, when a boy was given over to the carpenter, to the master carpenter, to be apprenticed to the carpenter, and if the boy didn't learn his lesson right and he messed up the piece of wood, so the carpenter would pick up that piece of wood and slam him over the head with it. And he would learn not to do that a second time. Now, when the boy got slammed over the head with the piece of wood, do you suppose he ran off to tell someone about it, to report that to someone, to expect some redress, some justice? No, there's no such thing. You know, it was even when I was a kid. You know, if you came home and said the teacher hit you, so your parents hit you. What did you do that made the teacher hit you? You know, they would, you know, nowadays, of course, you know, there'd be a grand general, grand board of inquiry, and, you know, at least half the administration would be fired, and, you know, the defects would be involved and everything like that. It's an entirely different world. Then in that era, there was a hierarchy. Along comes John Locke and others and begins to talk about humanity and rights. And he starts to talk about ideas that people are equal and that no person has a right to determine or force another person into a certain way of life. It was a very, very big change. Of course, the framers of the Constitution of the United States, in their Declaration of Independence, you know, when in the course of, you know, so on and so forth. So they said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And I've mentioned this before, the best way to argue a point, by the way, always the best way to argue a point. If you have a point to make, someone says, how do you know? It's self-evident. Respond to that sometime. What are you going to do with that? Self-evident. So we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. They're granted unalienable rights. Now, it is very interesting that in America, they said they were granted unalienable rights by their creator. The same version, if you read in France, you don't see any mention to the creator. It's very interesting. They left out God entirely. The American version was more like the English version, which was more influenced by the Puritans, and therefore God played much more of a role in all of that. When those ideas started to take hold in the world, first in the United States, which didn't amount to too much at that time, but then later on in France, those ideas presented a huge challenge to the Jewish people because they came along with the offer of emancipation. Circumstances were very grim for the Jewish people, and emancipation offered them a road out. In 1791, the soon-to-be-deposed King Louis, realizing that he was already in deep trouble, Louis, by the way, who at this point in 1791, this is just, you know, he's going to be dead within about a year or two, Louis, by the grace of God and by the constitutional law of the state, King of the French, Louis, who just a few years earlier, who had been king by the grace of God, but at this point he was already king by the constitutional law of the state. So he says, brings greetings. The National Assembly has decreed, and we wish to order the following. This is the decree of the National Assembly of France, September 27, 1791. The National Assembly, considering that the conditions necessary for being a French citizen and to become an active citizen are fixed by the Constitution, and that any man who brings together such conditions swears a civic oath and commits to fulfill all the duties that the Constitution imposes, has a right to all the advantages it ensures. And therefore, the National Assembly revokes all adjournments, reservations, and exceptions inserted into preceding decrees relating to Jewish individuals who take the civic oath, the doing of which shall be regarded as a renunciation of all privileges and exceptions previously inserted in their favor. Of course, it wasn't in their favor at all. It was against them. But we demand and order all administrative bodies and tribunals to enter this in their registers, read, publish, and post it in their respective departments and areas of responsibility, and execute it as the law of the kingdom and faith of which we assigned the president, and so on and so forth. In other words, what they basically said was, any Jew that takes the oath of citizenship swears an oath of allegiance to France is hereby considered to be a full citizen, which is a wonderful thing, and it brings with it many privileges. It also presents many challenges. So the Jewish people now had a big challenge in front of them. The challenge that they were facing is, what do we do now? Now that the gates are open and we can come out of the ghetto, as it were, what are we going to do? And how do we reconcile our Judaism, which for centuries upon centuries has been built upon the fact that we are strangers, isolated, and different, and never even deemed remotely acceptable to the general populace? Now we're going to be accepted by the general populace. How do we deal with that? Well, many Jews said, forget Judaism. Let's just leave. We'll assimilate. They're opening the door. Let's walk through it. Let's get out of here. Why would we want to stay in jail when we have a way out? So they took that opportunity. And some of them actually went off and were baptized. Many people just began to assimilate in France and in Germany. The other Jews weren't so quick to just assimilate, but they had this quandary. The Judaism that they knew is not going to work in the modern era, and therefore they realized that they had to either reform their Judaism or do something else with it to make it fit. And that's actually going to be next week's class. Rabbi Berger is going to be talking about the different forms the Jews came up with to make their Judaism work and how that all came about. Of course, there were a few, who found an appropriate Torah response. How to make the Torah relevant and speak to Jews under the new circumstances. But there was another group. And this is a very interesting group and stays with us really till today. These are people who don't want to be religious. They don't want to reform Judaism or come up with any new form of it. They don't believe in it. And yet, they're not willing to just walk away from it. They remind me of a fellow that I saw recently in the Beis HaMedrash on Shabbos afternoon. A young guy. This young guy came to the Beis HaMedrash one Shabbos afternoon with a textbook from a college course that he was taking. And he sat down in the Beis HaMedrash, and he was, learning up his textbook on Shabbos afternoon. Everyone else was there learning Torah. So he came there with his textbook. Why? Because, what's he going to do? It's time to learn. He recognizes that. Judaism and Torah has been about learning. Scholarship is what the Jewish people are. Scholarship cannot be ignored. The Gemara, whatever you want to say about it, cannot be ignored. The Gemara was a sophisticated discourse and development of law centuries and centuries before mankind knew anything about any of that. So you don't just turn your back one day because they're offering emancipation and ignore the Gemara. You don't blow off the Rambam. You don't just ignore Rav Sadia Gaon. And you don't call Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, a fool. No one's going to do that. So what do? Of course, you're going to study Torah. You're going to study Torah. But, on the other hand, I'm not going to observe any of it. That wouldn't fit and that wouldn't work. Hence is born the Maskil. What is the Maskil? The Maskil is intelligent, enlightened. He's going to study Torah. But he's going to study Torah according to a different set of parameters, different rules. He's going to take the modern rules of scientific inquiry and based on that, study the Torah. Now there is a history to this. The history to this is something that was going around the world in general at the time. The idea of studying religion and studying the Bible, things like that, according to scientific disciplines, was a new idea. The idea of rational approach and humanism, the new discipline of sociology, it's a brand new idea at the time, and actually even the study of history as a scientific discipline, all these things were very new and they were all going around in the world. The Maskil said, let's set it all to Torah. We'll take it to the new heights. Now, where did they get this idea in a religious sense? Actually, they were all preceded by a man named Mr. Wellhausen. And Mr. Wellhausen was a Bible critic. And Mr. Wellhausen was the father of Bible criticism and a major figure in a school of thought in Germany at the time, which was known as Wissenschaft des Judentums. I don't think you can say it without like lilting when you say the Judentums part. Otherwise it just wouldn't work out right. But what Wissenschaft means is the science of Judaism. There was a whole new discipline. To go back to Wellhausen for just a moment, this is where Wellhausen came from. Wellhausen says, we've got this book. It's called the Bible. It is extremely popular. People have been reading this for centuries. But up until now, no one knew about science. And no one knew about the disciplines of history and sociology and things like that. No one knew about archaeology. But now, in the modern era, we are learning all about all these new disciplines. Let's take all these new disciplines and examine carefully this book that's been around for years, the Bible. Now, he did it primarily with the Christian Bible, but, you know, Old Testament also. And lo and behold, what he came up with was the great idea, brilliant idea, an astonishing discovery, and that was that the Bible was not authored by God at all, but it was actually authored by five separate people. He never did pin down exactly when they lived, and he never figured out who they were, or even what countries they lived in. They didn't get too close, but he gave them initials. He gave them initials. And they were these four different people. One was E. E is based on the fact that whenever he refers to God, he uses the Elohim name. And J, because whenever he refers to God, he, whoever he was, uses the Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei name. There was P, who are clearly the authors of the book of Leviticus. That was the priestly class. And there was D, which is Deuteronomy author, whoever Deuteronomy was. And then, on top of it all, there was the great redactor. Right? Which I thought, actually, is a 50s song. You know, yes, I'm the great redactor. So, anyway, the great redactor, whoever he was, took all four versions and stirred it up, and voila, this, ladies and gentlemen, is your Bible covering both Old and New Testaments, and now everything's okay. Now, of course, when that idea was released, it was the result of scientific inquiry. At the time, everyone believed in all scientific inquiry. I mean, after all, the scientists had a lot of things going for them. People thought that they got a cold because they went out in the bad night air, and lo and behold, the scientists had a microscope and they showed you there's all these little things crawling around in a drop of water. It's brilliant. This is amazing. It makes people feel that all the old knowledge, everything that I knew and everything that I was told, was just fed to me by the old timers who were very narrow and didn't really understand the new science of the day. So therefore, when people came along with new theories, however even ridiculous and cockamamie they were, then no one, of course, was responding to any of those theories. So this was the theory. And Wellhausen founded schools of thought, and people discussed and debated and studied, and every day there was some new revelation. I mean, after all, I'm sure everyone here knows, why don't Jews eat pork? Come on, you all know. Trichinosis! Everybody knows that. That's like ABCs. I have a cousin that knows two things about Judaism. Only two things about Judaism. Matzah balls on Passover and trichinosis, why they don't eat pork. It's the only thing she knows. There's nothing else about Judaism, but she knows that Jews don't eat pork because of trichinosis. Those were the type of scientific inquiries that the Wissenschaft school was producing. The idea was, with a new look at things, yeah, doesn't that make sense? Of course, they didn't know about trichinosis, so the rabbis made it. And of course, along with all this, the rabbis made this up and the rabbis made that up. As long as you can find out the reason, and that spills into psychology, which is, of course, that was coming up. That wasn't yet even, maybe it was on the horizon, I don't know, but the psychology wasn't anywhere in vogue just yet. But certainly, archaeology and understanding what was going on in the Middle East at the time, and the position of the rabbis, understanding geopolitics and things like that, starts to explain everything that's going on in the Torah. And many young Jews got into this big time. Big time. Because they weren't willing to just turn their backs on centuries and centuries of scholarship. And they knew that the Torah was very deep. So they studied it. And they started to do things like write histories. The two great histories that were produced by Leopold Zuntz and Heinrich Gratz. And these were considered to be amazing acts of scholarship. Truth is, no one had written a Jewish history until that time. And based on all of their scholarly research, they defined Judaism. The way Gratz said Judaism was, that was what Judaism was. So I think, you had a class last week about the Hasidim and things like that. Well, Gratz told the world what the Hasidim were. The Hasidim didn't tell the world what the Hasidim were. Gratz, the way he analyzed it, the way he studied it, the way he understood it, that became the fact. He did research. He was a doctor. He was a professor. He was decorated and recognized in academia. And the Jewish world loved academia. The Jews loved and respected books. So they took these books, they took their studies, and a number of Jews turned their attention to the Torah. And in Western Europe, these people, it was generally referred to as Wissenschaft, which is scientific study. Now, it didn't stay in Western Europe because Mr. Napoleon Bonaparte decided that he was going to conquer the world. So when Napoleon went marching off to conquer the world, he did ultimately end up freezing and his army dying in Moscow. But in order to get from Paris to Moscow, there's quite a lot of land that you have to conquer in order to get there. And when Napoleon went marching off, Napoleon had the Napoleonic Code, which was very much based on the modern laws of the new rational era and the belief in the rights of man and all the declarations of the Republic of France. And in his wake, as his armies passed through, very, very brilliant man, he set up governments and he set up local councils and he instituted the law. French law became the law throughout Western Europe and into much of Eastern Europe. Now, of course, when he was driven back, a lot of it was repealed and all that, but once it was there, it was never really forgotten. And it gained a foothold throughout all of Eastern Europe. That's why the Jews had a really big issue about Napoleon. Is Napoleon good for the Jews, or is Napoleon bad for the Jews? Many Jews were praying for Napoleon. Emancipation, having civil rights, it's a wonderful thing. You know, and sometimes when I talk about this at Tamima, so, you know, and I tell them, they're always appalled when I talk about the fact that the Jews offered all these rights, like they so readily abandoned all their Judaism. It's just, they can't imagine. You know, how could that happen? So, you know, I asked them, what would you think if you went to get a driver's license and they looked at you and they said, Jew, get out of here? Can you imagine that happening? You ever think of that? In the state of Georgia? Could you imagine that happening? And, you know, they're all shocked because that's a very, very remote idea. Who could imagine such a thing happening? If you were living like that for centuries, whereas Jew, get out of here, and all of a sudden someone was offering you equal rights, maybe you'd grab it. That's why many, many people were praying for Napoleon. There were others that were praying against Napoleon. The first Lubavitcher Rebbe was a strong opponent of Napoleon and prayed for the Tsar. Now the Tsar was ruthless. The Tsar was horrible. The Tsar was like Paro in the Chumash. The Tsar was just horrible to the Jews. And yet he prayed for the Tsar. He said the Tsar believes in God. Napoleon doesn't believe in God. And it's better to live in a world that believes in God. Most Jews didn't believe that. Most Jews embraced the emancipation. And in truth, they have good reason to. The civil rights and the idea of appreciating the dignity of each and every person and understanding that if they are messed up right now, it's really due to their circumstances. And that was the argument. The Jews are only the way they are, which is, you know, smelly money grubbers and all that stuff, because that's the way we've been treating them. But if we would lighten up on them and incorporate them into the world, they would do wonders. And many Jews, when allowed into the world, really did do wonders. They turned the whole world upside down. But it takes a while, and this enlightenment, of course, doesn't know any end. Because once you take away any semblance, when it's total equality, so as we see today, everything is equal. Everything, everyone, the sexes are equal, everything's equal, children are equal, parents are equal, the sexes are equal, animals are equal, everything is equal, and ultimately it's the end of a society. But that's, you know, the rise and fall of societies. Where the Jews were, though, so the Jews were producing these scientific-oriented students of Torah. There was a fellow named Max Lilienblum. And Max Lilienblum brought this idea to Eastern Europe. And when it got to Eastern Europe, that's when it picked up the name Haskalah. It was the same thing in Western Europe, they just hadn't given it a name. They called it Wissenschaft. It wasn't like a movement, it was like a course. It was a type of study. But when it got to Eastern Europe, it was called Haskalah, and the adherents of it were Maskilim. And if you liked the Maskilim, that was a wonderful thing. If you didn't like the Maskilim, that was a dirty word. So what was with this guy Lilienblum? Where did he come from? What's going on? The Tsar, in 1845, stepped up his vigorous program of assimilating the Jews. And he really, really wanted to erase Judaism. He, the Tsar, ever since they had Poland had ceased to become an independent entity, they divided up Poland between Prussia and Austro-Hungarian Empire and Russia, the Tsar got the bulk of the Jewish people, and to which he promptly squeezed them all into the Pale of Settlement. But he was trying to figure out, what are we going to do with them? So he came up with a great idea. We're going to issue a series of decrees which will force the Jewish people out of the past and into the present as Russians. Now, in Western Europe, all this had happened very benignly. And actually, the government was very positive. It was inviting people in. We will accept you. Napoleon was really very positive about the Jews, although he wanted them also to assimilate. But by and large, he was positive about the Jews. He liked Jews. In England and in France, they were generally positive towards Jews, or at least they did it in more of a benign way. Yes, there was plenty of anti-Semitism, but it was done in a more of a benign way. But when you got to Eastern Europe, under Russia, was clearly a century behind. They were not emancipated. As a matter of fact, at the time of the Tsar in 1845, until 1855, when the Tsar died, Nicholas I died, and Alexander II, I believe it was, II, took over, they didn't have trains. They did not have telegraph, and they didn't have printing presses. Everything was extremely, extremely censored by the Tsar. They did not have newspapers. It was extremely backward. When Alexander came in, he liberalized all that. He freed the serfs and all those type of things. Changed things around drastically. But his father wanted to try to erase the Jews as a people. So in 1845, he made a number of decrees, which in Jewish history are referred to as the Gezerah. The Gezerah, the decrees. So, one of the decrees had to do with Jewish dress. The Jews, like everyone in the old days, used to wear a costume, you know, their own particular mode of dress. You could spot a person out, you could say, you know, he's a Serb, he's a Jew, he's a Ukrainian, and so on and so forth. Everyone was identified by their own distinctive mode of dress. The Jews had their own mode of dress. The Tsar outlawed distinctive modes of dress. Everyone heretofore had to dress in European fashion. That was a big, big, big issue. But he also appointed a man named Count Uvarov, and Count Uvarov decided what we need to do is we need to set up a Jewish school system. And the purpose of the Jewish school system will be to educate Jews in a modern fashion. And for that, he imported one of the scholars of Germany, this Max Lilienthal. He brings Lilienthal in, and the purpose of Lilienthal is to set up all of these local schools. And they gave all kinds of advantages to, if you went to these local schools, you didn't put your child in the cheder, and you went to the local, to the government-run school, then you got all kinds of opportunities. You could get into universities, you could get advantages, you could be released from onerous taxes, and all kinds of wonderful things. And, of course, the rabbis went to war against these innovations. And the rabbis labeled these people as maskilim. They are the intelligentsia. And they went to war against them. And they fought to get the children not to enroll in these schools and to stay in the traditional cheder system, not to go to the government schools. Ultimately, it didn't work very well. And ultimately, that plan pretty much fell by the wayside. The schools, the maskilim and their schools didn't take over. But where the maskilim really took off was when Alexander took over. When Alexander took over, he liberalized everything. And he opened up the world to ideas. He allowed newspapers to be printed. He allowed books to be printed uncensored. Now all of a sudden people could communicate. They built railroads. Someone could have an idea in Warsaw, and someone would know about it the next day in St. Petersburg. You can have an idea, you print it on a newspaper, you put the newspaper on a train, and the very next day, there it is in St. Petersburg. So ideas started flying around, and books started flying around, and books of all sorts. Books with prurient storylines. Scientific books. Books that had ideas that challenged the Torah. And these books started to find their way into Eastern Europe. And particularly, they started to find their way into the more educated realms in Eastern Europe. And that was the Yeshiva Bachrim. The Yeshiva Bachrim loved to study. They loved knowledge. And they ate up these books. And as the books started to come in, you start to hear these stories. You know, the guy who's caught, you know, with the book underneath his gemara, he's learning the gemara, but he's really reading the book. He stays up late at night, and he's reading books on biology and on sciences, and pretty soon he's reading books about all kinds of things about evolution and all kinds of different ideas, all of which are challenging the Torah. And everyone, and the parents get upset with them, they say, I don't understand. This is what we're all about. This is what it is to be a Jew. This is means to be intellectual. This is what it means. It means to be sophisticated. It means to be developed. It means to be pursuing knowledge. Isn't Judaism all about pursuing knowledge? So there is a woman named Yaffa Eliach who writes a book. She comes from the town of Eishishak. It's a town in Europe, in Lithuania. Had a great Lithuanian tradition of Torah study. So she documents the history of Eishishak for like 800 years or something. And she, of course, in more modern times, she documents it down in great, great detail. What she tried to do, the town was of course wiped out by the Nazis. And what she tried to do was she tried to record it to keep it alive. So she gives a lot of the history in as much detail as she can, and then basically describes the town in excruciating detail, person by person by person, up until the time of the Holocaust, and then describes what happened to the town. One of the things that she describes was, in every Jewish home, they had two tables. Two tables. This one table was where they ate and did everything at. That was the main table. And another table was the learning table. Depending on what level of learning ability you had, the father of the home sat and learned at the learning table. And he would have some type of Torah book there. If he was very educated, he would have a Gemara. If he was less educated, he might have a Chumash. And if he was even less educated, he might read Tehillim or something like that. But to have a Torah book and to have a Torah learning table in your house was standard. That was expected in any Jewish home. And she talks about how the Maskilim came to town. And the Maskilim opened schools such as the Tarbut school. Tarbut really means culture, which embraced Judaism. None of these people are saying, let's forget about being Jews. They love Judaism. But everything to be viewed in a scientific way and from a cultural perspective. So of course all of the holidays became agrarian festivals, and all of the various laws that the laws and the history, these things were, they chose the ideas and ideals that were important to them, you know, heroics and great battles, study of Tanakh and all of the history, heroes of the Tanakh, which they created, and the bad guys of Tanakh, whom they decided were the bad guys. And they started to present an entirely new view of Judaism and a different view of the world. Those schools started to flourish, and young people had to struggle over them. Matter of fact, if you read like the history of early secular Zionism, all of those people were produced by the maskilim, and they were products of the yeshivas originally, and they bailed out. Some of them, the parents sent them to the other schools. Some of them left the yeshivas and joined the other schools. Some of them just left altogether to go pursue their destiny. But the arrival of scientific study of Judaism in Eastern Europe really, really hit like a ton of bricks. Because in Western Europe, many people chose to express themselves in various different forms of Judaism. Or a form, or something that was akin to our conservative, or those various different forms. And many people just assimilated. In Eastern Europe, neither of those two popular options were available. Assimilation was not really available because the local populace was not anything that you'd want to assimilate into and was not very forgiving of Jews that came into their midst. They always treated Jews like Jews no matter what. So assimilation wasn't much of an option. On the other hand, they didn't buy this idea of coming up with a new form of Judaism. And I'm telling you the truth, I'm not really sure exactly why they didn't, but I suspect it was because they never really much admired the church. See, in Germany, when the Jews had an opportunity to emancipate themselves, they had a model that they really liked. The German church was such a wonderful place to be, you know, and it was, they sang nice songs, and they had an organ, and everyone sat decorously, and had a high ceiling, and the priests looked like priests, and it was very nice. It's a good place to be. So they wanted to reform their Judaism to look something like that. But in Eastern Europe, they never had any model that they admired. People didn't know about the church, and they didn't admire it at all. The church was evil to them. The church hurt people, hurt Jews all the time. The Jews weren't looking to the church. They weren't looking to reform Judaism. They didn't have any model. There was the Torah model or nothing. So if you don't have the assimilation model, you're not willing to go down that road, and you're not going to reform Judaism, so then what do you do? So you throw yourself into Jewish causes. And the Haskalah offered for Jews that option to be Jewish and intellectual. To be Jewish and feel like I'm part of the modern world. Yes, I'm Jewish. Yes, I study Talmud. But I study it in an intellectual fashion. I study it in a scientific fashion. It was very, very attractive to Jews. For a period of time. For a period of time. After a while, it burnt out. It burnt out because a big problem that the Maskilim had was you kept finding out what was really not true about the Torah. So that was basically what they did. Every time they came up with something new, yeah, you know, this story is not really like that. What really happened was like this. And he didn't really speak to God. He really did this. And this never really, miracle never really happened. What it was there was a rainstorm that day. And this never really, this was the rabbis made that up. Well, after a while it gets tired. It's so tiring. What do you need to hear that for? So what are we doing it for? If every day, you know, I'm going to find out every day, you publish a new book that shows you that this or that mitzvah is phony. Well, I know. So, you know, after a while, you know, I need to buy another book to find out that the Torah is phony. You already proved it to me. The last 500 guys that wrote books like that already proved it. So it started to burn out. And they started to realize they didn't have anything going for them. And at that point, that's when they started bailing out and they started looking into other things. Nationalism became a big thing. Social rights and promoting the Bund and communism and socialism, all these type of things. But they all started off at their core with Jews who are maskilim. Now, from the Torah perspective, how did they fight this? By and large, you know, poorly. They didn't really do a very good job. But the first thing that they did was that old standard is, your treif, get out of here. You're treif. That's all there is to it. There's a classic story that is told, which I actually heard from Rav Ruderman in Baltimore, Zichron Livrach, the Rosh Yeshiva in Baltimore. So his roommate, when he went to the Slobodka Yeshiva, was a fellow named Saul Lieberman. And Saul Lieberman later on went on to become, I don't know exactly what his title was, but a very important person in Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, conservative. I don't know if he was the provost or rector or whatever, I don't know what exactly the title was, but he was a big man. And a learned man, he spent time in Yeshiva. So the altar of Slobodka, who was looking out for Ruderman, wanted him to grow in a Torah way and not be infected by other ideas. He didn't like the roommate. He didn't like this Lieberman. He thought Lieberman was too prone to, he's going to movies and different things like that. And too many like liberal ideas. He didn't want that to infect the young Yaakov Ruderman. So he pulled him out of there and he had him living with him in his house. And he grew up away from the evil influences of Saul Lieberman. So anyway, turn the clock ahead 70 years. They're in New York. It's now 1970s. They're in New York. And Rabbi Ruderman is staying overnight in New York. He's in New York for some reason, and he's staying overnight in a hotel. And one of his students comes in and says, I have a phone call. Saul Lieberman wants to see you. Your old roommate, haven't seen each other in decades and decades, and he lives here in New York. He wants to get together, talk about old times, you know, whatever it was, reminisce about the Slobodka Yeshiva, whatever. So Rabbi Ruderman said to his student, let's go for a walk. And he went out for a walk. And he walked. After a while, student says, you know, like, maybe it's time to go back. No, let's keep walking. And they walked for hours. They walked for hours on end until it was late, late into the night. And then he came back very late at night. So he said, like, what's going on? So he said, you know, I know Lieberman wanted to come over and see me, and I wanted to be out so late that he wouldn't be able to see me. So he said, why? They said, because the altar of Slobodka told me I shouldn't hang out with him. Here it was, like decades and decades later. Right? So one of the ways that they fought the Haskalah was by trying to insulate. They tried to insulate. There were other things, though, that they did. Many things that the Maskilim picked up on became treif in yeshivas. One of them, and it's a pity, but one of them was Tanakh. The study of Tanakh was a big, big maskil approach. The maskilim studied Tanakh a lot. They liked the study of Tanakh and the Bible stories, get to the bottom of it, what's really going on, analyze it scientifically, words, structures, archaeology, the whole bit. No God, but, you know, understand the science of it. And in the yeshivas, we don't study Tanakh. We just learn Gemara. Gemara, Gemara, more Gemara. No Tanakh. Don't study any of that. The Maskilim were big into Jewish poetry. We don't do poetry. Poetry is treif. No poetry. In other words, everything that they pursued, the yeshivas reacted to and said, that's treif. We don't study that. Because those guys are studying it, and they were studying it in a treif fashion, meaning in a maskil fashion. Excluding the first thing that you do, by the way, if you're maskil, when you study, the first thing you have to do is you have to put God out of the picture. Because that's not honest inquiry. That's not scientific inquiry. If you presume that there's a God, that's not scientific inquiry. If your scientific inquiry leads you to the conclusion that there is a God or that this was written by God, that's one thing. But you can't start off with that prejudice, otherwise it disrupts the whole approach. So therefore you have to start off by presuming that the Torah is something other than godly. So if that's the approach, so the antidote to that was, is whatever they touch is treif. They had mixed results, to be sure. The results were, you know, questionable. In some cases, they were successful. In many, many other cases, they're lost. Would they have done better? Was there another approach? I don't know. I have no idea what would have been a better approach. But in many cases, it went down the tubes. Now, some of the approaches that have become very famous today, such as Musar and even Hasidus, were all employed to fight the Haskalah. It is unclear to me. Many people say and like to write up Rabbi Yisrael Salanter as being as having devised this whole approach as a pushback to Haskalah. I don't know that that is actually the case, and I think that I'm not so convinced about the evidence to that. But it certainly was used that way. I don't think that's why Rabbi Yisrael planned it. I don't think that's where he was going. But it certainly was used as that and was successful. In that, Hasidus, in its own way, was successful by embracing the dynamism and the otherworldly experience. That was also successful to a certain extent. But by and large, the Haskalah, because it was the prevailing philosophy, which we live with even unto this day, because it was the prevailing philosophy that really, really carried the day, and many, many people were sacrificed to that, were lost to that, because there wasn't really an effective Torah response. I think, actually, it's only in more modern times that people have found that something of that age of reason leaves us empty. We're missing something. If we don't feel the spark of the divine, and the Jewish soul yearns for that. And nowadays, it's not so embarrassing to say that you believe in other things and in greater powers and in unseen forces. That's not so strange. But if you talk to people from a certain era who grew up with that whole idea, the belief in the science, you know, you always, that picture of the guy holding up the beaker, you know, like, and it's kind of like there's rays of light coming off of him. He's wearing a white lab coat, maybe even like little glasses, protective glasses. He's looking at the beacon. Better life through science, better life through chemistry, whatever it is. So people that grew up in that era, like the lady that I quoted in the beginning, people who grew up in that era were people that couldn't buy it. You know, yes, she can hear you. A dead person can hear what you're saying? Science hasn't shown that dead people can hear what you're saying. As a matter of fact, science tells us dead people can't hear what you're saying. So it can't be. And I'm not willing to accept that. And that was how entire generations, centuries, two of them to be exact, were raised. I think that we still do have that until today. We still have that sort of chip on our shoulder and feel that we, because we do live in a rational world. And you can see this whenever you hear debate going on. If you listen to some debate that you'll hear in the media, let's say someone were to talk about any contemporary social issue. So, homosexuality, that's the issue of the day, right? Everything's, we're totally, totally, the society is absolutely and totally obsessed with it. So if someone says, well, I believe that God says, everyone's like, please, we're trying to have a rational discussion on the topic. You know, you can, God says, you want to believe in that? That's nice. Please, we're trying to be rational here. Rational means good, right? Rational equals good. Irrational, bad. God, irrational, bad. Okay? Nice, you, but you know, keep it to yourself. So we still do suffer from that. We still do live with that. That is the result of the age of reason. Haskalah was the Jewish version of trying to be the enlightened scientist, but the enlightened scientist in Judaism, using Torah as my tool. And therefore, you'll find all these wonderful books and collections, Legends of the Talmud by Ginsberg, all these great, undertakings where they put together and they collected so many things and studied the Talmud. And this is the, and actually, the, you know, it's a cartoon, it's a caricature. But my father, Olav Shalom, actually told me that this is something they had a principle in their Talmud Torah afternoon Hebrew school when he was a child. And the principal, literally, this is like I said, it's like a caricature. The principal would study every Shabbos afternoon, would take out his Gemara and light up a cigar and study Gemara. What better thing in the world? What does a Jew do on Shabbos afternoon? Study the Talmud. What's greater than Gemara? It has nothing to do with God. It's a great product of the Jewish people. And he'd smoke a cigar because he enjoyed a good cigar. What better than to enjoy a good cigar on a quiet Shabbos afternoon over a folio of Talmud? Just be sure that you don't get any cinders into the page. You don't want to burn it up or anything like that. So there were people like this. That's how they taught their Judaism. That is what they believed in. To tell him not to study Talmud, horrible! I'm a maskil! And they were proud of themselves. And they were proud that I am the descendant of the people that produced the Talmud. And yes, all those people, they had their hang-ups, but you have to understand the time and the place. And of course, yeah, they professed to have believed in God. Maybe they did believe in God. Maybe they didn't believe in God. What does it matter? But they were very, very intelligent people. And it's so interesting. It's a nice, it's such a fascinating thing. And I'm so proud to be part of them. And I am a maskil. I am an intelligent, enlightened human being. From the word maskil is seichel. I have seichel. So that really ruled. The Maskilim ruled Judaism, and they laid down many of the ground rules and many of the fundamental beliefs. From the Maskilim, the other movements within Judaism drew all of their support. I mean, after all, you couldn't have reform without trichinosis, right? They didn't come up with that stuff. The Maskilim came up with those type of things. But the other movements drew upon it because it all had to start from somewhere. You know, this is like the a study that I read not too long ago professors at leading universities, and they found that majority of professors at universities don't believe in God. But when they broke it down, they found that mostly the ones in the humanities don't believe in God. Amongst the scientists, they found that many people, that a large proportion, did believe in God. And interestingly enough, when they asked people, and why don't you believe in God? So all the professors in the humanities said, because it's been scientifically proven that there is no God. Because the scientists didn't say that. But the humanities people did. So the Haskalah produced the groundwork that enabled the Jewish people to cut itself loose from the Torah, because it made the Torah the product of man. And although these Maskilim studied it, because in one sense, in one swift generation, they're not going to walk away from it, so they studied it and they were dedicated to it, but of course it didn't carry on. You don't hear about generations of Maskilim still continuing to study the Torah. They did, however, provide the fundamental belief system for all of the various different approaches to Judaism, including nationalism and socialism and Zionism, all the various different approaches. They all drew from the fundamental work of the Maskilim, who showed that the Torah really wasn't the product of God. And that being the case, now we're free and clear to move on to wherever it is that we want to go on to. So anyway, that is, I just want to mention, in closing, that the Maskilim were responded to. Although by and large, the Torah world, I don't think, had an effective response. Well, they didn't have an effective response because large numbers of youth defected. So obviously it wasn't an effective response. But I don't want to say that there was no response. And there were people, particularly there was a fellow, an Italian fellow named Cassuto, who wrote, and he proved that the biblical, that the whole documentary thesis, the idea of multiple authors to the Torah, was not sustainable from a reading of the Torah. And he showed that because he said, when you read any work, you have to presume its thesis. You can't presume antithesis and then show that the thesis is wrong. You have to presume the thesis and then show that it doesn't work out. But if you presume the thesis of the Torah, it does work out. Similarly, the Malbim wrote, Rabbi Meir Leibush, and he wrote a fantastic, fantastic commentary in the Torah. And he showed how each and every word was laden with meaning and had to be exactly the way it was, which again blew off all of the Maskilim. And he was a big, big, big enemy of the Maskilim. And of course, Rav Hirsch, in many ways, although his enemy was the Reform, but Rav Hirsch in many ways shows again the proper discipline and the appropriate approach to Torah, which makes Torah very, very meaningful. So all of these and others, they did respond. They did respond. The times were such that, you know, they didn't affect a lot of people. But for us now, maybe for the generation later that's returning to Torah, so there is a tremendous amount of Torah true response to the Maskilim. Then, and last but not least, are many, many, many a story that is told about many great Torah scholars, probably not told by other people because we never heard that story, but many great Torah scholars who, when they were identified as youngsters, became the prize goal of the local Maskilim. Rav Aaron Cutler is a great one of those. He was known to be a genius. He showed tremendous prowess in mathematics and in other disciplines, and the Maskilim really desperately wanted him. And there were battles, literally pitched battles over these kids between the rabbis and the Maskilim. Again, I would assume in most cases the Maskilim won. Otherwise there'd probably be a lot more great scholars and Torah sages around. But in many cases they won. But in a minority of cases, with very, very great and popular exceptions that are household names to in the Jewish world today, they didn't win. And some of those people, they went on to make great changes and to really accomplish things that set up our Jewish life until today. So, although the Maskilim accomplished much, they were part of that time and that era. And when I look back at it and I try to ponder it and to see, was there something wrong? Was there a weakness within Judaism that it wasn't able to effectively respond? I have to ask myself, were the conditions such that any response would not have been effective? Because the people were looking to get away, because the world at large was such a great lure, I don't know that any real response would have been effective. So they didn't come up with a really effective one. However, the Torah does survive. And the Torah goes through, because all of these other approaches and all of these new trends, and therefore I will leave you with the one thought that when you see the new trends today that always happen to be coincidentally so in sync with whatever the zeitgeist is, with whatever is going on in the street, with ideas that have been invented from the world out there and don't come from Torah. And we see new movements and they come along and they come, but they go. And the Maskilim are just another one of those long, a long train of attempted variations and digressions from the Torah, which ultimately leads to their disappearance. I don't know if anyone knows any grandchildren of Maskilim. I don't know, you know, it's just, you never hear about it too much. But I don't know. We do know of grandchildren of Torah scholars. We don't know too much about grandchildren of Maskilim. These things come and these things go. And I think that everyone should always take a look at anything that comes along and try to put it in that type of context, and then we'll appreciate it better. Okay. Thank you all for coming.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.